I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, dialogue partner of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which, before other revolutionary events in China, convened for what could be called a Tianjin turning point in human history. The so-called West, which never really existed, is over, and the world has gone back to what it was before the couple of centuries of Anglo-Western European imperial genocide and slaughter. Not that you'd know it if you see today's latest US-UK-EU armed Holocaust images from this region. There is little of today's final day of a week-long series of military exercises carried out by Russia and other members of the Collective Security Treaty Organization in Belarus can do to defeat the Trump-backed Zionists carrying out genocide. Except maybe to deter a NATO nation-armed Israeli war on Iran. Iran's Pezeshkian was with Putin and Xi Jinping and nuclear North Korea's Kim Jong-un this week at parades of Chinese military power. No wonder the old imperial power opium-dealing Britain, with once the biggest empire in history, is down to ringing every phone tomorrow in an emergency siren test to calibrate its nuclear war survival skills. And the United States, it's ordering extrajudicial killing on small Caribbean boats. Joining me again from Russia's capital, Moscow, is political analyst at the Valdai Discussion Club and former Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council, Dr. Andrei Kortnov. Dr. Kortnov, in NATO nations, World War II was something fought in Western Europe, even though historians have long pointed out that the war began 2 years earlier in China in 37, 20 million Chinese killed before 27 million Russians. What did watching the 80th anniversary of the victory of Russia and China in Beijing this week, what did it mean to you and what did it signify?
I think it is important to put the record straight and to make sure that it was not only about Europe, it was about Asia. And of course, the Chinese contribution to the victory in the Second World War was quite significant, especially if we keep in mind that China at that point was a divided nation. And it was very difficult for communists and Kuomintang to put aside their political disagreements and to unite forces in order to fight a common enemy. For the Soviet Union, I think the Chinese engagement was also very important because that was one of the reasons why Japan ultimately decided not to invade the Soviet Union. It got so engaged in the conflict with China, ultimately decided to go south rather than to go north. So it is important. It doesn't mean that other nations did not contribute to the victory in the Second World War. I think that we should remember all the countries that were fighting against the German Nazism, against Italian fascism, against Japanese militarism. But it means that, of course, we should put all the efforts of many countries into the right historical context. And China, indeed, suffered quite a lot.
Well, growing up in England, they didn't really teach you about the Russian contribution in World War II, I'm afraid to tell you, Dr. Kortnov. But anyway, this is a headline from it fancies itself as a British newspaper. It's Japanese, the Financial Times. Before the Paris summit, the confusion about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting in Tianjin and the commemorations in Beijing, perhaps emblematic here. Europe laying roadmap for deploying troops in Ukraine, von der Leyen says. Security force takes shape. US backstop key to plans. Paris summit this week. I mean, What do you think the U.S. vassal states have up their sleeve? Is this just all propaganda media that doesn't even understand the security situation? What on earth is Britain, I think Sir Richard Dearlove, former head of MI6, talking about the need for some kind of conscription, and all these economies in Western Europe in deep economic trouble talking about the need to send forces to potentially go to war and kill Russians?
Well, personally, I do not see how Europeans can deploy their forces in Ukraine without a very clear and very strong engagement by the United States. They will need U.S. security guarantees. They will need something similar to Article 5 of the Atlantic Treaty. And so far, President Trump was not very clear on what kind of security guarantees he can provide and what kind of engagement the United States is ready to grant to its European partners. So I remain skeptical about this idea. I know that many in Europe do not want to put their soldiers at risk. And I think that, you know, if we are talking about security guarantees in Europe, these security guarantees should be inclusive. They should include Ukraine, but they should also include Russia. Otherwise, if any side feels insecure, it will be tempted to revise the status quo. So I think that if the idea is to provide security guarantees to only one side of the conflict, it's not likely to work.
Yeah, I mean, it is confusing. In the NATO Nation press, it is even published here, Trump touted Chinese troops for Kiev. I presume they mean Kiev. Trump touted Chinese troops for Kiev. I mean, clearly, Donald Trump is up for debate about security guarantees, if he can think of that. And, of course, China, they could have discussed it, although very little from the SCO meeting directly about perhaps a Chinese peace plan or the use of Chinese troops in Western, in Eastern Europe to protect the interests of the new world order.
Well, so far, the Chinese position was that Beijing is not ready to deploy its troops in Ukraine. But I think that a lot will depend on what the mission of these troops might be and what format this military engagement might take. If we are talking about a standard peacekeeping operation, then it should be authorized by the United Nations Security Council and it should be delegated to the UN Department on Peacekeeping. And then the department should think about what particular nations can or might contribute the needed forces. If the idea is that it will be a decision by the European Union or by the NATO alliance, then we have a problem, because definitely this is something that the Russian leadership is not likely to accept, and we will have a situation of continuous insecurity in Europe. So we should be clear on what we want to accomplish. If the idea is to have international monitors along the line of contact between Russia and Ukraine, we tried it with the Minsk agreements, and OSCE was engaged in monitoring the implementation of the Minsk agreements. There were about 700 observers monitoring the 400-kilometer line of conflict. But both sides had complaints about the OSCE mission. Both sides suspected that OSCE was not really neutral. I think that we might confront the same problem once again.
We interviewed one on this program. The whole thing was a sham. We know Minsk was a sham because of Angela Merkel. I've got to ask, why is Putin acting as if there's any possibility of trust, acting so diplomatically? What was your reaction when you heard the Russian president even thinking of the Zaporizhia power plant, the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe, somehow going to be monitored in a tripartite fashion with the United States and, I don't know what type of country he means, and Ukraine? What was your reaction when you heard Putin say that? I think it was with Fitzo. Is Vladimir Putin just putting it out there? Or is Putin being fooled yet again, as he was by Minsk?
Well, no, I hope that the Russian leadership is not going to be fooled by anyone, but they're looking for a solution. I think that they understand the gravity of the situation. You take the power plant, and it's not Kinderspiel. It's not something that can be easily managed. If anything happens to the Zaporizhzhia power plant, we might have another Chernobyl in the center of Europe. And of course, we can imagine that the International Atomic Energy Agency should be involved. I think that Russia has displayed a degree of flexibility, suggesting that there should be a kind of multilateral international monitoring mission. But so far, we have not accomplished too much with these ideas. And we see that the Zaporizhzhia power plant is under attack again and again. I'm very concerned that something might happen, and we might have a real problem there, because, of course, this is a very serious potentially a very serious challenge to European security, which will affect not only Ukraine, not only Russia, but it might affect other European countries as well.
Every living organism on the earth, if Chernobyl was to go by, but not the IAEA, surely, yet again. I did hear that it was the Iranians are saying that it was the Russians forcing the IAEA inspectors to come to the Bushehr nuclear plant, about 100 miles or so from the studio I'm talking to you in Dubai, because Russia still cooperates with the IAEA. Obviously, Iran doesn't like it because they've accused the IAEA of being filled with spies. Why does Russia continue to support these multilateral institutions that have become whose reputations are in tatters now in the Global South and presumably all across the tea rooms of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting in Tianjin this week?
Well, I agree with you that many international institutions, even the institutions working under the auspices of the United Nations, are not ideal. And they might be politically biased. They might contain a lot of red tape. They might be incompetent in certain ways. These are the institutions that we have. These institutions have a degree of legitimacy. They are universal. They are representative. I think that instead of trying to dismantle them, we should try to make them work better. We should try to increase their efficiency. And countries of Global South should have, of course, more say in defining how these institutions operate. These institutions cannot be hijacked by any particular group of nations. And unfortunately, from time to time, such attempts do take place. So it is a problem, and it is not an easy problem. But again, these are the only institutions that we have for the time being, and they do have some expert knowledge. They do have some track record. It's better to have them rather than not to have them. Of course, if at some point BRICS or Shanghai Cooperation Organization finds a new set of international institutions that would demonstrate that they are more efficient than the existing ones, maybe ultimately these institutions will take over. But it's not a far process.
Dr. Andrei Kordonov, I'll stop you there. More from the former Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council and political analyst at the Valdai Discussion Club, Dr. Andrei Kordonov. Earlier, you spoke about the OSCE, people talking about the corruption of that. Isn't the fundamental problem here that countries like Russia and China and India, actually, given the tariffs, don't understand NATO strategic preemptive behavior? So the coup in 2014 in Kiev, so the more drones and more munitions now being sent, and more MI6 agents and trainers being sent into Ukraine to send drones to St. Petersburg and Moscow, the presumably some people expecting a war on Iran from an Israel full of weapons sent to by Trump. Isn't it time for these countries to understand that they have to preemptively attack to defend? Otherwise, they will continue to be weakened, as they have, say, in Syria, allowing the genocide in Gaza.
Well, you know, preemption might be a very appropriate strategy, but it's a very risky strategy. If we are talking about responsible powers, usually they do not preempt. They do not escalate. They prefer to react to some changes in the international environment. If you look at China, for example, you'll see that on very many issues, China takes extremely cautious approach. You know, they don't want to somehow provoke a conflict with the United States around the island of Taiwan or in the South China Sea. Even if you take Iran, and if you look at the Iranian reaction to the most recent U.S. strikes and Israeli strikes against the Iranian nuclear infrastructure, you'll see that the Iranian reaction was very, very well calibrated and very moderate. Iran doesn't want to get engaged into a large regional war. And I think it's the right approach. I think that the repercussions of such a conflict can be very grave, not only for Iran, but for the whole region.
So Russia can just, I mean, that's very a point well taken, but then Russia is just going to wait for all these new munitions that are being sent in by Europe. I mean, the business pages in Europe. Europe bets on military spending. They, if you believe it, they're going to impoverish their entire societies, turn themselves into wartime economies, to pour military infrastructure into Ukraine, these small drones, and just continue battering Russia. What does Russia do then? Because, as you say, China's not going to come to the rescue. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is not going to come to the rescue of Russia. How will the Russian people take it? And won't they say to Putin, this war of attrition should be sped up into something more final and something more swift?
Well, I think that what the Russian military command is doing, it is trying to intercept the inflows of the military hardware to Ukraine from Europe, and of also, of course, the Russian strikes are supposed to degrade the Ukrainian military industrial complex to prevent Ukraine from producing these drones that attack Russian regions far away from the Russian-Ukrainian border. Of course, you can question whether it is enough, whether Russia can really achieve its goals by working on the NATO military hardware on the territory of Ukraine. But I guess that so far the perception is that the mission can be accomplished by hitting the transportation routes and the warehouses where the U.S. produced military equipment is stationed. We will see, but this is the tactics which is apparently used by the Russian army at this particular juncture.
So just a slow advance to Odessa then. I mean, I'm talking about preemption because I noticed the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Development Bank is being talked about. Similarly, wasn't it time to preemptively attack SWIFT, MasterCard, the Visa organization to speed these new methods of trade and transfer preemptively rather than continue to allow companies like Visa and MasterCard to operate, let alone the IMF and World Bank to continue to operate? Isn't it time for some kind of preemptive sanctions against these hegemonic institutions?
Well, I agree with you that definitely one could have thought about alternative institutions and payment methods in advance. But it was so convenient. It was so nice to use Visas and MasterCards and the SWIFT system in general For a long period of time, nobody thought that Russia could be kicked off, out of SWIFT, or Visa might leave Russia. Nobody thought that Russian currency assets could be seized by the European Union and other Western countries. So Russia learned its lessons hard way. And definitely right now, I think it will not repeat the mistakes that it committed earlier.
It appears that Trump is beholden to all sorts of interests right now. Jeffrey Epstein interest, it seems, if you believe the US media most of the time. Are these Shanghai Cooperation Organization members, do they understand that there is a big military-industrial complex in the United States, and as they go to war, perhaps with Venezuela, and back a war on Iran, as well as soup up all sorts of tensions that they can in the South China Sea, how can they calibrate, for all their big parades in Tiananmen Square, how can these SCO members calibrate some kind of response without the United States perhaps not being strategically victorious, but certainly creating chaos and preventing the new world order that the Global South dreams of?
Well, first of all, you should keep in mind that neither SCO nor BRICS can be considered military alliances or, integration projects like the European Union. If you look at members within SCO, you'll see that they might have very different views on security priorities and security concerns. Look at India and Pakistan. Of course, they consider each other as the major challenges to national security of their countries. You cannot imagine that all the BRICS members or all the SCO members can be united in a integrated
but is there going strategy. To be, sorry to interrupt, is there going to be some type of integration? I mean, I didn't even understand. It was only the other day that India signed the deal with Pete Hegseth for a 10-year military partnership with the United States. Presumably, in Tianjin, they were already discussing some elements of integration. They are already integrated with Russia's military components and armaments to an extent. Is everything just in total flux at the moment?
If you remember, SCO started as an organization fighting against the so-called three evils, terrorism, extremism, and separatism. Even on these relatively non-toxic issues, there are many disagreements within member states. They can exchange military information. They can promote mil-to-mil conflicts. They can talk about confidence-building measures. They might even participate in some joint military exercises. But I don't think that in the immediate future, SCO might emerge as a kind of integrated political military alliance against the West, against the United States, or against other Western countries.
But it's not against, as they keep saying. It's not against. It's just defensive against. And unlike the way NATO says defensive, this obviously really is defensive, given the number of wars in recent years. I know you have to go, so you're very busy, but I do want to talk to you about START. But just because I'm talking to you from this region, if this war in Iran does start, how important is it going to be to disarm Israel's nuclear facilities? Because it's the nuclear weapons of Israel, more than even the START negotiations that I know you wish are going to be renewed next year. How important and how concerning is it that Israel could resort to nuclear weapons should there be a conflict with Iran? Because Iran now has hypersonic missiles that can hit Israel.
Well, it's a very good question. We don't have a clear answer whether Israel might consider using nuclear weapons against any of its neighbors. 2 years ago, I would say, it is absolutely out of question. Nuclear weapons of Israel are just for deterrence. Israel is not in a position to use nuclear weapons against any of its neighbors and not against Iran. These days, you cannot be sure of anything. I think that Israel is purposely trying to preserve the situation of strategic ambiguity. And that
well,
relates,
that's gone. That's gone. Everyone knows that ambiguity is gone. But now, Kim, now, of course, 400 kilos of enriched uranium have gone missing in Iran. The parliament wants out of the NPT, and Kim Jong-un is close to Iran. Could Kim Jong-un help in some sort of nuclear deterrent to prevent Netanyahu using nuclear weapons in this region?
Well, I'm not sure that Netanyahu will listen to anyone, maybe except for Donald Trump. Only the United States can provide enough pressure on Israel to change the Israeli behavior. But I'm skeptical even about the U.S. capacity to have a serious impact on Netanyahu. Now, Trump might disagree with what Netanyahu is doing in Gaza, but Netanyahu doesn't stop. And he's not likely to stop in any immediate future. So I think that Netanyahu acts as a loose cannon. Maybe, you know, when they have elections in Israel next year, there'll be a change of the ruling coalition, and maybe we will see new faces in the Israeli leadership. But unfortunately, right now, when I observe the political trends in Israel, my conclusion is that Netanyahu might face more challenges from the right rather than from the left. He is criticized even by more radical political groups within his own political coalition, and that, of course, you know, is something that creates uncertainty about the future of the Jewish state at large, and about the future of the Israeli foreign policy in particular.
Dr. Andrei Kurtonov, thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That was unusual.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed genocide here in the Middle East. We'll be back on Monday with a former chief of staff at the US State Department. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.